Hello, everybody. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Deuteronomy chapter 32. I'm going to do the first 43 verses of the chapter, which encompass the Song of Moses. In our previous chapter, we saw God telling Moses that Joshua was to succeed him and how to take care of that. Remember, Moses is on the plains of Moab. He's on Mount Nebo, actually, speaking to the Israelites arrayed below. He's giving them three discourses all through the book of Deuteronomy, and now he's on his last one. He's in the famous Song of Moses. So we will start now with Deuteronomy 32, verses 1 through 4. Pay attention, heavens, and I will speak. Listen, earth, to the words of my mouth. Let my teaching fall like rain, and my words settle like dew. This is Moses speaking. Like gentle rain on new grass and showers on tender plants, for I will proclaim Yahweh's name, declare the greatness of our God, the Rock, capital R, in the Holman Christian Study Bible, the capital R, Rock. His work is perfect. All his ways are entirely just. A faithful God without prejudice. He is righteous and true. Now I'm going to give a literary opinion of the Song of Moses. From Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, quote, on the inimitable excellence of this ode, much has been written by commentators, critics, and poets, and it is allowed by the best judges to contain a specimen of almost every species of excellence in composition. It is so thoroughly poetic that even the dull Jews themselves found they could not write it in the prose form, and hence it is distinguished as poetry in every Hebrew Bible by being written in its own hemistiches, or short half-lines, which is the general form of the Hebrew poetry. And were it translated in the same way, it would be more easily understood. The song itself has suffered both by transcribers and translators, the former having mistaken some letters in different places and made wrong combinations of them in others. As to the translators, most of them have followed their own fancy, from good Mr. Ainsworth, who ruined it by the most inanimate rhyming version, to certain latter poets who have cast it unhallowedly into a European mold. Well, Adam Clark is an expert on everything. He's a polymath. He's also a literary critic, so I take his words for that. Here's what Jameson, I said that was Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. Actually, that was Adam Clark who said that. This is what Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown said. The magnificence of the exordium. The exordium is the first part of the poem. The magnificence of the exordium, the grandeur of the theme, the frequent and sudden transitions, the elevated strain of the sentiments and language, entitle this song to be ranked amongst the noblest specimens of poetry to be found in the Scriptures. Now, I don't know whether it's because I'm reading it in the NASB and the Holman Christian Study Bible translations, but my impression when I first read it is, my gosh, you're writing a song and then you just dump on the Israelites that the song was written for. I mean, he really dumps on them. And usually you don't do that in songs. So I think it's kind of an unusual song myself. Moses says in verse 2, let my teaching fall like rain. The teaching, of course, is the law of Moses, the Pentateuch, the Torah. It's interesting that it's said to fall like a gentle rain, because often the common perception of the law of Moses is fire, brimstone, and judgment, as we'll see in a minute. But Moses looks like it says it's like gentle. Well, he says it's like rain falling and his words are like dew settling on the grass, like gentle rain on new grass and showers on tender plants. Well, that's because the law does give life to people who keep it, but people who don't soon become acquainted with the harsher aspects of the law. Now in verse 4, Moses said that God is the Rock, capital R, Rock. Now rock is a place that signifies a place of defense and security. And so that's a good metaphor. God is our rock, he's our security, he's our defense. But Adam Clark makes the point that that Hebrew word can be translated as origin or fountain or first cause. God is our origin. He's our source, like a fountain. The source of a fountain is the water that comes out of the ground from the source. So God is our first cause. He's our origin. Well, that's true, but I'm not an expert in Hebrew, so I don't know. So I just give you that as an alternate translation, but I prefer rock. He is our rock and our refuge. Nothing going to touch us if we're in him. Now, this idea of God being a rock is a major theme in the Song of Moses. As we go through this chapter, we can look at verses 15, 18, and 30 through 31, and we see that metaphor used several times in Deuteronomy 32:15. Then Jeshurun, that's Israel, became fat and rebelled. You became fat, bloated, and gorged. He abandoned the God who made him and scorned the rock of his salvation. Deuteronomy 32:18. You ignored the rock who gave you birth. You forgot the God who gave birth to you. So God is a rock. Deuteronomy 32:30-31. How could one man pursue 1,000 or two put 10,000 to flight unless their rock had sold them, unless the Lord had given them up? So God is called the rock there. But their little r rock, in quotes, air quotes, but their so-called rock is not like our capital R rock, even our enemies can see. Not only in the Song of Moses, but also in Genesis 49:24, we see God called a rock again, yet his bow remained steady, and his strong arms were made agile by the hands of the mighty one of Jacob, by the name of the shepherd, the rock of Israel. The bow there belongs to Israel. It remains steady because Israel's strong arms were made agile by the mighty one of Jacob, the rock of Israel. And also the rock as a figure of speech is used in Psalms and Isaiah, also, which I won't read, as the NIV Study Bible points out. So this is a common metaphor. God is our rock. Before we go to the next verse, I need to point out that there are actually three songs of Moses. There's one in Exodus 17 where the Israelites celebrate the passing through the Red Sea. They say, the horse and rider hurled into the sea. And then there's Psalm 90, which is also called a song of Moses, because it's a psalm written by Moses. But this is the longest song of Moses and the one that I think most people refer to when they say the song of Moses. We go now to Deuteronomy 32, verses 5 through 7. His people have acted corruptly toward him. His, Yahweh's people have acted corruptly toward Yahweh. This is their defect. They are not his children, but a devious and crooked generation. Now, this is why I think it's so funny. You're starting out a song, and you start out by saying, what a bunch of losers you are. Verse 6, is this how you repay the Lord, you foolish and senseless people? Isn't he your father and creator? Didn't he make you and sustain you? Remember the days of old. Consider the years long past. Ask your father, and he will tell you, your elders, and they will teach you. So what is their defect, as verse 5 says? Well, their defect is that they're a devious and crooked generation. The King James has their spot. Their spot is that they're a devious and crooked generation. The spot would be an allusion to the marks which idolaters put on their foreheads or arms in various colors or forms. Sometimes they're straight, or oval, or circular shapes, according to their favorite idol, as Jameson Fawcett Brown points out. So they were marked just like idolaters were marked. The Israelites are called a devious generation. The NIV has warped. They are a warped generation. Philippians 2:15 says this. This is Paul in the New Testament. So that you may be blameless, you Philippians, and pure, children of God who are faultless in a crooked and perverted generation, among whom you shine like stars in the world. So we've been living amongst perverted and crooked generations for all of human history. In fact, Jesus called the Jews this wicked generation and various forms of that. Matthew 17:17, Jesus replied, you unbelieving and rebellious generation. So the Jews kept it right on up till their Messiah came. Their perversion, their defect, their warpedness, their deviousness, their crookedness. Is this how you repay the Lord? Moses says, isn't he your father? Now, God is Israel's father, Isaiah 63:16. Yet you, Yahweh, are our father, even though Abraham does not know us and Israel doesn't recognize us. You, Yahweh, are our father from ancient times. Abraham doesn't know the people and times of Isaiah because about 700 years, well, more than that, 1,300 years have passed. And so they didn't know Abraham and Jacob didn't know the Jews in the time of Isaiah, but God knew them because Isaiah says, you, Yahweh, are our father from ancient times. You've always been our father. In Isaiah 64:8, yet, Lord, you are our father. We are the clay and you are our potter. We all are the work of your hands. So Moses continues, isn't he your father and creator? And then he says in verse 7, remember the days of old. Consider the years long past. Ask your father and he will tell you. Well, who is the father that you're supposed to ask? Well, it could be your immediate parent, which is what I think it is. Or it could be an elder person, ask your elders. So father would be sort of in apposition with your elders in verse 7. John Gill even says it could be ask Abraham by consulting the writings of Moses who wrote about Abraham. Well, maybe. I think it's just ask your father. Because the Jews were great at keeping the traditions of the Jews intact throughout the years. Now, it says to ask your elders. Now, that might be a problem because some of their elders were, of course, not there because they all died in the wilderness because they listened to the evil report of the spies and didn't listen to God. And so God said, you're all going to die in the wilderness if you're over 20 years old. So the fathers of the people that Moses has spoken to would be, or the elders would be kind of gone. However, you could read about what happened. I'm sure somebody wrote it down. Now, some people say ask your elders means your ancestors, like the people who were alive during the time of Noah, and they will teach you about how God sustained you. Now, that idea comes from reading verse 8, which we'll get to in just a minute. It doesn't say that it belongs to Noah, but many people think it does. And so the NIV Study Bible, for example, thinks that. And so they say, going from verse 8 back up here, the elders that are asked are the people at the time, the sons of Noah. I don't think so. John Gill says it's the ask the prophets. Gill quotes some rabbis, but I don't know what prophets they were between Abraham and Moses. Well, I just think what Moses is saying, ask the people who are older than you, who knew the history of Israel. Some of them might have died out, or most of them might have died out in the wilderness, but there's still going to be people around that know because things get passed down. So ask them. Remember God. God is very big on that, remembering the history of his people, because it's the history of his work and redemptive history and salvation history. And it's easy to remember that stuff. After all, we are still talking about the crossing of the Dead Sea, are we not? And we all know what the golden calf incident is, do we not? Deuteronomy 32, verses 8 through 9. When the Most High gave the nations their inheritance and divided the human race, Moses continues, he, Yahweh, set the boundaries of the peoples according to the number of the people of Israel. But the Lord's portion is his people, Jacob, his own inheritance. Now, God is called Most High in verse 8. This is the only time in Deuteronomy that God is given this name of Most High. He is called Most High in the incident where Abraham met the head of the coalition he led against the kings that came in from the Mesopotamian Valley, from Elam, Chedorlaomer, and all those guys, if you recall, in Genesis 14. And so Abraham, after the conflict, is talking to Melchizedek, king of Salem. Genesis 14, verse 18, Melchizedek brought out bread and wine. He was a priest to God Most High. He blessed him and said, Abram is blessed by God Most High, creator of heaven and earth. And I give praise to God Most High, who has handed over your enemies to you. So Melchizedek was calling God Most High. And Abram himself, in Genesis 14:22, in the same incident, said to the king of Sodom, I have raised my hand in an oath to Yahweh, God Most High. This is when Abraham made that deal with the cities of the south, that little alliance there. Five kings Abraham had against the four kings that came from the Mesopotamian Valley. And they were talking after the battle was over. And basically Abraham is saying, look, I am not going to take money for you in payment for what I did for you, Sodomites, because I don't want anybody to say I'm dependent on you. And that was such a big deal to him. He says, I have raised my hand to Yahweh, God Most High. The NIV Study Bible says that the phrase Most High, or Lord of Heaven, or Creator of Earth, applied to the chief Canaanite deity of ancient times. And I don't know what chief Canaanite deity they're talking about. I thought that was Baal, but whoever it was, he was called the Most High, the Lord of Heaven, the Creator of Earth. And so Moses is using the term referring to God, showing he's ahead over everybody, all the idols. He gave the nations their inheritance, and particularly he's talking about the Canaanite nations that surround Israel, as John Gill says. He gave them their inheritance. This is described in Genesis 10, the so-called Table of Nations. We look at the descendants of Noah and how they fanned out and what land they got, and that's why people say that verse 8 refers to Noah. And that's why people say that Moses is asking the Israelites to ask your elders, meaning ask the sons of Noah. I think that's a stretch, but anyway, that's the way the argument goes. So the nations are given their inheritance. He set the boundaries of the peoples according to the number of the people of Israel. That means God has got to make room for the people of Israel, so he's going to push the boundaries of the pagan peoples back to create a hole, if you will, in the map so that Israel can walk into it. God is in charge of the boundaries. Then, as the NIV Study Bible says, the grant of Canaan to the Israelites was sufficiently large to contain the expected population. So he set the boundaries of the Israelites according to the number of the people of Israel. And he set the boundaries of the peoples, the nations, accordingly also by shrinking their boundaries or expanding the Israelites' boundaries at the expense of the nations. And then he says in verse 9, but the Lord's portion is his people, Jacob, his own inheritance. This is after Moses, of course, has called him a devious, crooked, perverted, devious and crooked generation with a defect. I just love that. He's called them foolish and senseless in verse 6. Oh, but they are God's chosen people. The Lord's portion is his people, Jacob, his own inheritance. You can't help but notice that conflict. This is an illustration of why there's so much grace in the Old Testament, because there's so much sin in the Old Testament, and God still looks over the sin in order to save the people from their sin. The application of that, of course, is to us. We are such wretched sinners before we know Jesus, and then Jesus takes us and cleans us up and changes our nature from that of a sinner to a saint. We go down to Deuteronomy 32, verses 10 through 12. He found him, that's God found Israel, in a desolate land, in a barren, howling wilderness. He surrounded him, cared for him, and protected him as the pupil of his eye. He watches over his nest like an eagle and hovers over his young. He spreads his wings, catches him, and lifts him up on his pinions. The Lord alone led him, with no help from a foreign god. Now, God found Israel in a desert, barren, howling wilderness. Howling is a common oriental expression for a desert, because the desert is infested by wild beasts, and the wild beasts are the ones doing the howling. Oh, 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 which sounds exactly like my house every night when the dogs in the neighborhood start howling. Now, where is this wilderness that God found the Israelites in? Well, you could say in Goshen, except that was not really a wilderness. I tend to think it was Arabia, or the Sinai Desert. He surrounded him and cared for him and protected him as the pupil of your eye. If you think about the pupil of your eye, it's surrounded by the colored part, the iris, and that means it's very well protected. It also has an eyelid that goes over it, and then you can put safety goggles on top of that. A pupil is something that's very valuable because you can't see without it, and it's protected. And Israel was protected in the same way. Verse 11, he, God, watches over his nest, over God's nest, like an eagle, and hovers over his young. Now, interestingly here, the NIV and the Holman Christian Study Bible don't translate watches over as watches over. They say that the translation should be, he stirs up his nest like an eagle. Well, if that's what he does, if that's the proper translation, then that means that the eagle is stirring the nest up to get the young out of the nest so the young will know how to use its wings and fly, as Gill and Clark say. Just like God got Israel out of Egypt, he stirred their nest up and said, you're not going to be a slave anymore, let's get out of here. Now, the eagle is said to hover over his young, just like God hovers over the Israelites. Here's what Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say about that. Quote, when her newly fledged progeny, talking about the eagle, when her newly fledged, that means newly born, progeny are sufficiently advanced to soar in their native element, she, the eagle, in their first attempts at flying, supports them on the tip of her wing, encouraging, directing, and aiding their feeble efforts to longer and sublimer flights. Now, the eagle is hovering over the young, and I think what Jameson, Fawcett, Brown means is that the eagle watches the young eagle flying, and when the young eagle looks like he's about to fall out of the sky because he gets tired, the eagle swoops down, puts the end of his wing under the baby eagle, and holds him up. And then when the young eagle, gets totally tired and is about to fall out of the sky, then the eagle will lift up the baby eagle on his pinions. A pinion, of course, is a claw. And so when the young eagle gets tired of flying, the eagle grabs him by his claw so he doesn't die. And, of course, that's a great metaphor for God looking after Israel, because they certainly needed looking after. Verse 12 says that the Lord alone helped Israel, with no help from a foreign god. Of course not, because God does not need the help of idols, because idols are no gods. Now, it means when God says, I alone did it, he means alone with no other gods. It doesn't mean that he didn't use human agents. Obviously, Moses and Aaron led the people. Psalm 77:20 gives the idea of both of human agency and God's providence. Psalm 77:20, you led your people like a flock by the hand of Moses and Aaron. So God did the leading, but Moses and Aaron had a hand in it. We go now to Deuteronomy 32, verses 13 through 14. Moses continues in verse 13 and 14. He, that's God, made him, that's Israel, ride on the heights of the land and eat the produce of the field. He nourished him, God nourished Israel, with honey from the rock and oil from flint-like rock, cream from the herd and milk from the flock, with the fat of lambs, rams from Bashan, and goats with the choicest grains of wheat, and drank wine from the finest grapes. Now, what are the heights of the land here? Jameson, Foster, and Brown say that's probably referring to their home in the Transjordanian territory. God made Israel ride on the heights of the land. That's where they are now, as Moses is speaking these words. But there's another option. It could be forward-looking to the land of Canaan. They would live in the hills of Canaan. Adam Clark says this, all the verbs here are in the future tense because this is a prophecy of the prosperity they should possess in the promised land. That's what Clark says, but the Homo Christian Study Bible and the NIV have it in the past. He made in the past, made him ride. So I'm not going to get into that. The point is that when you're riding on the heights of the land, that means you're overlooking the land. That means the land is yours. Jameson, Foster, and Brown says about the high places. Quote, the high places and the fields are specially applicable to the tablelands of Gilead, as are the allusions to the herds and flocks. Gilead, of course, is that strip of low land that's right to the east of the Jordan River, running from the Sea of Galilee to the tip of the Dead Sea. Jameson, Foster, and Brown calls them tablelands here. And so also the high places and fields are relevant for Gilead, and also the herds and the flocks. The honey of the wild bees, which hive in the crevices of the rocks, oil from the olive, as it grew singly or in small clumps on the tops of hills where scarcely anything else would grow, the finest wheat. So in other words, Jameson, Foster, and Brown says that Moses is describing the Transjordan area. I don't know about that. I think he could be describing, looking ahead and describing Canaan. Honey from the rock. Why does honey come from rock, you might ask? Well, because bees often make their hives among the rocks. Isaiah refers to this in Isaiah 7:18-19. On that day the Lord will whistle to the fly that is at the farthest streams of the Nile, and to the bee that is in the land of Assyria. All of them will come and settle in the steep ravines and the clefts of the rock. So bee, this is a metaphor, bee referring to Assyria, but the bee comes and lives in the clefts of the rocks, because that's where bees do. They put their hives in there. So that explains why God nourished Israel with honey from the rock and oil from the flint-like rock. Well, how does oil come out of flint-like rock? As the NIV Study Bible and John Gill say, it's because olive trees often grew on rocky hillsides. And of course, olive trees are everything in the ancient Near East, in the Middle East, in Israel, everywhere. And so oil came from the flint-like rock because oil came from those olive trees. And then, of course, the cream that's referred to, cream from the herd, that would be the sheep and the goats, referring to curds, curdled milk. Rams from Bashan and goats are mentioned. Bashan, of course, is that fertile area to the east of the Sea of Galilee. And as John Gill points out, rams and goats of the best sort were bred there in Bashan. And in verse 14, he mentions wine. You drank wine from the finest grapes. The NIV translates wine as foaming blood. Ooh, that's a translation. Now, if that's referring to the future Canaan and not the Transjordan area, then we can also point out that Deuteronomy 8:8 does the same thing. Canaan is a land of wheat, barley, vines, figs, and pomegranates, a land of olive oil and honey. We go now to Deuteronomy 32, verses 15 and 16. Then Jeshurun, that's Israel, became fat and rebelled. You became fat, bloated, and gorged. He abandoned the God who made him and scorned the rock of his salvation. They provoked his jealousy with foreign gods. They enraged him with detestable practices. Now Jeshurun, as the NIV note says, means the, quote, the upright one. And of course that's referring to Israel. And again, that's sort of an ironic name, the upright one. The crooked and perverse generation, the spot, the defect, the senseless, rebellious people of Israel are called the upright one, Jeshurun. But they became fat and they rebelled. Now this term Jeshurun is only used in three other places in the scripture, according to John Gill. I'm going to give you one of them, Deuteronomy 33:5, in the next chapter. So he, God, became king in Jeshurun when the leaders of the people gathered with the tribes of Israel. So Jeshurun is another name for Israel, like Jacob is, like Joseph is. The Israelites rebelled. Verse 15 says, the NIV says they kicked, which is the same thing as meaning rebelled. A horse will kick its owner as it struggles to get loose. I used to own a horse, tried to feed him, walking beside him near his hindquarters, and next thing I know, his foot is stretched out sideways trying to bowl me over. And if he'd have hit me, he'd have put me in orbit. Well, that's good when you think about people rebelling, kicking against God. Israel abandoned God, scorned the rock. There's the God again called a rock. I won't read that again. I've already read the verses in the Song of Moses where God is called a rock. They provoked his jealousy with foreign gods, idols. They enraged him with detestable practices. God is called a jealous God. And you know, these atheists, they like to say, well, what kind of a God is it that's jealous? Well, he is jealous because he demands your loyalty, just like a husband or a wife demands their spouse's loyalty. We don't think anything wrong about that. But oh no, the atheists have got to get all upset because God is jealous. He doesn't want his people worshiping other gods. Deuteronomy 32:17-18. They, that's the Israelites, Jeshurun, the upright ones, they sacrificed to demons, not God, to gods they had not known, new gods that had just arrived, which your fathers did not fear. You ignored the rock who gave you birth. You forgot the God who gave birth to you. Now, when is this referring to? When did they sacrifice to demons? Well, it could be the golden calf incident at Mount Sinai, but I don't think so, because it says in that same verse 17, the sacrifice was given to new gods that had just arrived. That's probably, in my opinion, Baal Peor on the plains of Moab, that famous incident which we went over. Remember the incident of Phinehas? The Midianites allied themselves with Moab, and then the daughters of Moab seduced the Israelites into having sex with them in the tents, and Phinehas got mad about it and stabbed, forgot their names, a Moabite woman. I don't remember whether it was a Moabite woman or a Midianite woman, but you know the story about Phinehas. And then a plague broke out because of the idolatry. Well, that was a good example of a new god. It's new because they weren't familiar with Molech and Baal Peor on the plains of Moab. They got there, and then they sacrificed to them pretty bad. Again, this is assuming this is in the past tense, which Home and Christian Study Bible is in the past tense. You ignored the rock who gave you birth. Now, notice verse 17 directly identifies worshiping idols with worshiping demons. Verse 17, they sacrificed to demons. It doesn't say they sacrificed to idols, which they did, but they sacrificed to demons, because there's always demons behind these idols. In fact, we read in Leviticus 17:7, they must no longer offer their sacrifices to the goat demons that they prostituted themselves with. So when the pagans were sacrificing to their idols, they were sacrificing to goat demons in Leviticus 17:7. I don't know exactly what a goat demon is, but it's a demon. We go now to Deuteronomy 32, verses 19 through 21. When the Lord saw this, he despised them, provoked to anger by his sons and daughters. He said, I will hide my face from them. I will see what will become of them, for they are a perverse generation, unfaithful children. They have provoked my jealousy with their so-called gods. They have enraged me with their worthless idols. So I will provoke their jealousy with an inferior people. I will enrage them with a foolish nation. Now, this provoking the Israelites, making them jealous, making them enraged, this is quoted by Paul in a famous spot, Romans 10:19. But I ask, Paul says, did Israel not understand? First, Moses said, I will make you jealous of those who are not a nation. Paul is quoting Moses right here in Deuteronomy 32, verse 21. First, Paul says, Moses said, I will make you jealous of those who are not a nation. I will make you angry by a nation that lacks understanding. So Paul shows that Moses was predicting the conversion of the Gentiles. The Gentiles would be blessed, and the Israelites would be jealous because the Gentiles are blessed. God, why did you take our kingdom away from us? Aren't we the chosen people? Well, I know, but you sin so much that now the Gentiles are going to get the benefits of my blessings. Adam Clark says this verse contains a very pointed promise of the calling of the Gentiles, talking about in Deuteronomy 32, verse 21, so I will provoke their jealousy. This verse contains a very potential promise of the calling of the Gentiles in consequence of the rejection of the Jews. And to this great event, it is applied by St. Paul in Romans 10:19. Now it says, Moses says in verse 21, I will enrage them, enrage the Jews with a foolish nation. It doesn't say nations. Gentiles are usually called nations. So it's not looking for a particular nation. It's just talking about the Gentiles in general. God's going to make the Gentile nations happy while he's making Israel miserable. Of course, all of this reminds us of what Jesus told the Jews in Matthew 21, verse 43. Therefore, I tell you, the kingdom of God will be taken away from you and given to a nation producing its fruit. Given to a nation is referring to the Gentiles, and it's singular too, so you can see the expression refers to all the Gentiles. We go now to Deuteronomy 32, verses 22 through 25. Moses continues speaking in God's voice, Deuteronomy 32, verses 22 through 25. For fire has been kindled because of my anger, God's anger, and burns to the depths of Sheol, hell. It devours the land and its produce and scorches the foundations of the mountains. I will pile disasters on them. I will use up my arrows against them. They will be weak from hunger, ravaged by pestilence and bitter plague. I will unleash on them wild beasts with fangs, as well as venomous snakes that slither in the dust. Oh, what a great song this is. Outside, the sword will take their children, and inside there will be terror. The young man and the young woman will be killed, the infant and the gray-haired man. Well, not exactly Cole Porter lyrics. Now, of course, we're not getting the full poetic effect of this because the translation is not poetic, but the subject matter is really pretty awesome for a song. Okay, so God's fire burns to the depths of Sheol. That's as far down as you go. It refers to the grave, the underworld, where departed spirits live. The fire of God devours the land and its produce. Whether the produce is standing in the field or whether it's been reaped in the barns, God's fire will go out and burn it all up. The fire of God's anger will scorch the foundation of the mountains. Now, it's interesting that some of the rabbis interpret the mountains there as Mount Zion, the city of Jerusalem. We could quote Psalm 125, verse 2, to back that up. Jerusalem, the mountains surround her. And so, according to this rabbi, the foundation of the mountains refers to the mountains around Jerusalem, the particular mountains around Jerusalem, and God's anger is going to scorch even that. Well, that could be, because Jerusalem got wiped out by the Babylonians. I will pile up disasters on them. In verse 23, when could that be fulfilled? Gill and Clark mentioned 8070 by the Romans. Yeah, that fits the bill pretty good. How about Babylon? 586 BC. How about Assyria? But Assyria, I don't think, because Jerusalem itself was not destroyed. However, Assyria did wipe out the northern 10 tribes. And if mountains is just a generic reference to mountains and not to Jerusalem in particular, then Assyria could be said to fulfill these disasters. I will use up my arrows against them. Well, of course, that's an easy metaphor. An arrow kills you. Lamentations 2:4, Jeremiah says this, He, God, has bent his bow like an enemy. His right hand is positioned like an adversary. He has killed everyone who was loved, pouring out his wrath like fire on the tent of daughter Zion. Wow. Some more powerful rhetoric for judgment on Israel. Now, in verse 24, we see the traditional four judgments listed. This shows up in Revelation. It shows up in a lot of places. But the four traditional judgments of God are famine, pestilence, wild beast, and the sword. Famine number one, pestilence number two, wild beast number three, and the sword number four. And we see all of that here. There will be weak from hunger. There's your famine. Ravaged by pestilence. There's your pestilence and bitter plague. Wild beast is next. I will unleash on them wild beast with fangs, as well as venomous snakes that slither around. And then last of all, outside the sword will take their children. So this is standard Hebrew rhetoric. Four classical judgments. Let me say them again. Famine, pestilence, wild beast, and the sword. God had promised a visitation from wild beasts in Leviticus 26:22. I will send wild animals against you that will deprive you of your children, ravage your livestock, and reduce your numbers until your roads are deserted. We go now to Deuteronomy 32, verses 26 through 27. I would have said, I will cut them to pieces and blot out the memory of them from mankind, if I had not feared insult from the enemy, or feared that these foes might misunderstand and say, our own hand has prevailed. It wasn't the Lord who did all this. Now, verse 26 is in the subjunctive. I would have said, I will cut them to pieces. God never did that. The Jews are still with us. Unlike the Amalekites, the Moabites, the Midianites, the Edomites, and the Babylonians, they're all gone now. It's the enemies of the Jews whose memories have been blotted out. Now, why did God not blot out the memory of the Jews? Because the enemies of the Jews would say, see there? There Yahweh was not a God, because he couldn't even protect his own people. You remember Moses had that same problem. I don't have any sites with me in front of me, but he was constantly saying, God, if you wipe us out, what are your enemies going to say? Now, the foes of Israel might understand and say, our hand destroyed the Jews. But there was one enemy of the Jews, the Romans, under Titus, the general Titus. He was smart enough to realize it wasn't him that burnt the city down in AD 70. He was smart enough to say that Jerusalem was so strong, it had to be God who delivered it to him. But a lot of pagans wouldn't think that way. We go down to Deuteronomy 32, 28 through 30. Israel is a nation lacking sense, with no understanding at all. If only they were wise, they would figure it out. They would understand their fate. How could one man pursue 1,000, or two put 10,000 to flight, unless their rock had sold them, unless the Lord had given them up? Now, there's a little ambiguity in the translations here. Holman Christian Study Bible has Israel is a nation. The NIV says they are a nation. The Holman Christian Study Bible just assumed it is Israel being talked about here. And it could be the pagan nations or nations lacking with no sense and understanding at all. But I don't think so. John Gill suggests that it's the pagan enemies. But I'm going to go with the Holman Christian Study Bible. Israel is a nation lacking sense because they're so rebellious all the time. And they'll get themselves in a situation where one man of an enemy will pursue 1,000 Israelites. That's pretty good odds for the Israelites, and yet they lose. Or two men put 10,000 to flight. That's even better odds for the Israelites, and they still lose because their rock, i.e. God, had sold them into slavery because of their sin. Deuteronomy 32, verses 31 through 33. But their rock is not like our rock. Now, there's a lot of pronouns in this verse, and they're disputed. I'm going to read it like I think it is and try to explain it as I go by. But their rock, that's a little r rock in quotation marks, as the Holman Christian Study Bible puts it. But their so-called rock, the pagan nation's so-called rock, is not like our capital R rock, not like our God, as even our enemies concede. Actually, I'm wrong here. I was talking about pronouns. That's in a later verse where there's, well, even in this verse, there's questions on who's being talked to. As we go through here, we'll see several verses where it's hard to tell whether it's Israel that's being talked about or the enemies of Israel. But so far, verse 31, there the pagan nation's rock is not like our rock, not like Israel's rock, God. Even our enemies concede that. For example, in Exodus 14:25, God caused their chariot wheels, the Egyptians' chariot wheels, to swerve and made them drive with difficulty. Let's get away from Israel, the Egyptians said, because Yahweh is fighting for them against Egypt. Even the bad guys, when bad things happen, they say, ooh, we don't want to mess with Yahweh. And of course, that quote from Titus that I just gave you, Titus said only God could have delivered Jerusalem to the Romans, so he acknowledged God, even though he was a pagan. How about Balaam refusing to curse Israel? You know the story. Balak of Moab called him down from near Syria to come down to Moab and curse the Israelites. And Balaam, he wanted that money, but several times, Balak took him from one mountain to another and said, curse him. And Balak said, I'm not going to curse him, because he knew who he was messing with. He was messing with Yahweh, and he didn't want to cross him. So the enemies of God oftentimes conceded the power of God. For their vine is from the vine of Sodom. Well, there's a pronoun. Which way does that there go? Is it the enemies of God make poisonous vines, or is it Israel themselves is the poisonous vine? Well, I found one commentator that said it's the enemies of God that have a vine that produces poisonous grapes. But I found five commentators who said, no, the poisonous vine is Israel producing poisonous grapes. So I'm going to go with the majority view here. Affirming that view that the poisonous vine is Israel are the commentators Ellicott, Benson, Colin Delitch, Matthew Poole, and the Pulpit Commentary. The Cambridge Commentary, on the other hand, said it's Israel's enemy. So it is a little ambiguous. We'll go with the majority view. For their vine, the Israelites' vine, is from the vine of Sodom and from the fields of Gomorrah. Ooh, you can't ask for a place more destroyed than Sodom and Gomorrah. Their grapes are poisonous. Their clusters are bitter. Their wine is serpent's venom, the deadly poison of cobras. Ooh, that's a great metaphor. Drink wine, it's like drinking serpent venom. We go now to Deuteronomy 32:34. Is it not stored up with me, sealed up in my vaults? Well, the first question is what is it? Is it not stored up with me? We've got two options, basically. It could be the sins of the Israelites are stored up and sealed in God's vaults. The Pulpit Commentary suggests that. And if so, the it refers to the past, the sins of the Israelites. The pulpit commentary says the it could refer to judgments about to come on Israel because of those sins. That's referring to the future. And the pulpit commentary and Colin Delitz say it's actually both. It's the sins of the Israelites are stored up, and the judgment for those sins is also stored up, sealed in God's vault. Now, the NIV Study Bible says, puts it this way, God's plans for punishing sin in the future are fixed and certain. That's what sealed means. When you seal something, that means nobody gets in there to change it. Nobody's going to break into God's vaults and interfere with his plans because his vaults are sealed. You can't get there. You can't change them. Adam Clark says that deeds are engagements by which persons were bound at a specified time to fulfill certain conditions were sealed and laid up in places of safety. So it was not exactly the vault that was sealed, but Clark says deeds are sealed, paper documents are sealed so that people can't get to them. So the idea is God's intention to bring judgment is fixed, and nobody's going to change that. We go to Deuteronomy 32, verses 35 and 36. Vengeance belongs to me. I will repay. In time their foot will slip, for their day of disaster is near, and their doom is coming quickly. The Lord will indeed vindicate his people and have compassion on his servants when he sees that their strength is gone and no one is left, slave or free. Well, first of all, for the general idea that vengeance belongs to God, and of course the implication is it belongs to God only, not to us. Hebrews 10:30, for we know the one who has said, vengeance belongs to me, I will repay. Well, the author of Hebrews is quoting here, chapter 32, Deuteronomy, from the Song of Moses. And then Paul in Romans 12:19 says, friends, do not avenge yourselves. Instead, leave room for his, God's, wrath. For it is written, vengeance belongs to me, I will repay. Direct quote here from Deuteronomy 32:35. Now, when it says vengeance, that word might be a little bit slippery in English. If a human pursues vengeance, he's pursuing revenge, which has bad connotation because it's not just. It's just personal animosity. But justice, if vengeance means justice, well, then it's perfectly okay. And, of course, that kind of vengeance can only come from God. Quote, from his, as John Gill says, quote, from his hatred of sin, his strict justice, and his faithfulness to his threatenings as well as his promises. Now, in verse 35, God says, in time their foot will slip. Now, in time might just mean sooner or later, it's going to get here. Or the King James translates it differently. They say, in due time. Now, the due is in italic, showing that it's not in the original Hebrew. But the idea is, when the appointed time has come, as John Gill says, in due time, when the cup of their iniquity is filled. Now, the question is who's the there? In time, their foot will slip. Well, here's the two options. Again, it could refer to Israel's enemies, not Israel. Or, option B, it could refer to Israel. Well, Colin Delitzsch say it refers to Israel. On the other hand, Gill says it refers to Israel's enemies. Now, we can look at the context to try to figure it out. It says Israel is vindicated in verse 36, so that would make it sound like it was God's enemies that were getting judged, and as a result, God vindicated Israel. Judgment in verse 35 on enemies, verse 36, Israel vindicated. Well, so there are your two options. Whose foot will slip? John Gill says it's Israel's enemies. Colin Delitzsch say it's Israel. I'm going to make the case it's Israel's enemies when we get to the next verse. So right now, let's just assume it's God's enemies. Their foot will slip. The day of disaster is near. The doom is coming quickly. Well, actually, I'm going to make the argument right here. Their doom is coming quickly. What does quickly mean? Well, the day of disaster for Israel was not till 722 B.C. for the northern 10 tribes and 586 B.C. for the southern tribes, and that was centuries after the Jews crossed the Jordan River and went into Jordan. We're now around at the turn of the century between 14 and 1300 B.C. That's centuries before 722 B.C. when Assyria wiped out the 10 northern tribes. That's not quickly. So I think that it makes more sense to say in time the enemies of Israel's foot will slip, their disaster is near, their doom is coming quickly because the Israelites are coming to cross the Jordan River. Well, whoever verse 35 is referring to, the people who vengeance is coming upon, the people whose foot will slip, the people whose day of disaster is near, whether it's Israel or they're Israel's enemies, and I believe it's Israel's enemies, either way, verse 36, the Lord will indeed vindicate his people and have compassion on his servants. So whether the Israelites were being chastised or whether They were being protected by destruction being rained on their enemies' heads. Either way, they're vindicated, shown to the world to be God's people, despite their many sins. We go down to Deuteronomy 32, verses 37 through 39. He will say, that's God. God will say, where are their gods, the rock they found refuge in? Who ate the fat of their sacrifices and drank the wine of their drink offerings? Let them rise up and help you. Let it be a shelter for you. See now that I alone am him. There is no God but me. I bring death and I give life. I wound and I heal. No one can rescue anyone from my hand. Well, here we have a whole bunch of pronouns. There in verse 37, there in 38, them in verse 38, and then it in verse 38. And the question is, the same question, is it Israel or is it Israel's enemies? So let's start with verse 37. God will say, where are their gods? Where are Israel's gods? Well, who agrees with that interpretation of the commentators that I've found? The pulpit commentary, Kylan Delitch, Matthew Poole, and John Gill says, we're talking about Israel here. I couldn't find anybody saying it was Israel's enemies, so we're going to take it as Israel. So verse 37 says, he will say, where are Israel's gods? The little R rock they found refuge in, the so-called rock, not a real rock, but a so-called rock, these gods. Where are they? Because everything's destroyed. And if the previous verses refer to the enemies of Israel, as I do believe it does, they do refer to, and then God will look down at the destruction and say, okay, where are your gods? They didn't save you from destruction, you pagan enemies of Israel. Now, verse 38, who ate the fat of their sacrifices and drank the wine of their drink offerings? Well, notice that sacrifices and drink offerings could be offered to idols or they could be offered to Yahweh, because both religious systems had sacrifices and drink offerings. So again, the there is ambiguous. Who ate the fat of whose sacrifices? Israel's sacrifices or Israel's enemies' sacrifices? Kylan Delitch says it refers to the pagan gods' sacrifices. So the result of this, if both of these interpretations are correct, is the Israelites had been sacrificing to pagan gods, which doesn't surprise me. So let's back this up again. Verse 37, where are Israel's gods, their gods? 38, who ate the fat of these gods' sacrifices and drank the wine of their drink offerings? Well, that would be Israel. Let them rise up and help you. Not the Israelites, but let the pagan gods rise up and help you, Israel. Let it, the rock of the pagan gods, let that so-called little R rock be a shelter for you. Verse 39, see now that I alone am he, there is no God but me. Well, of course there's no God but God, Yahweh. Deuteronomy 4:35, you were shown these things so that you would know that the Lord is God, there is no other besides him. The Lord our God is one God, the Shema, Deuteronomy 6. Now, this one God in verse 39 says, I bring death and I give life. Well, that means death to the bad guys and life to the good guys. Whether the bad guys are pagan enemies or Israel, they're going to die if they disobey God's holy word. It says, I wound and I heal. Well, he wounds for punishment and heals for preservation. Just depends on what your attitude is toward God and his holy word and his holy law. This sounds like a well-known verse in Isaiah 45:7, I, Yahweh, form light and create darkness. I make success and create disaster. I, Yahweh, do all these things. Now, a lot of people, this is a verse that's used in the Calvinist Arminian controversies. I create darkness. That doesn't mean that God creates evil. It just means he creates disaster on people who oppose him. He's bringing judgment on people who need judgment. Now, if you're going to say that's evil, well, then you got a problem of evil. You got a problem of God creating evil. But if you're just saying it's God's justice, that's not evil. Justice is a good thing, not a bad thing. We go now to Deuteronomy 32, 40 through 53, and we will finish this audio. I, that's God, raise my hand to heaven and declare, as surely as I live forever, which of course he does, when I sharpen my flashing sword and my hand takes hold of judgment, I will take vengeance on my adversaries and repay those who hate me. He's already mentioned that vengeance and repayment once, and he mentions it again. I will make my arrows drunk with blood while my sword devours flesh, the blood of the slain and the captives, the heads of the enemy leaders. Notice the slaves there, or the POWs, I should say, not slaves. The POWs that are captured, no, they're going too. Rejoice, you nations, concerning his people, for he will avenge the blood of his servants. He will take vengeance on his adversaries. He will purify his land and his people. I love reading verses like this because in American culture, the idea of judgment and justice and payment for sin, the idea of sin, the idea of eternal punishment, all of this is completely wiped out of our culture, and we're going to pay for it one day. We're going to pay for it dearly, but it's gone now. But if you read this, you realize, boy, it's a different worldview. Back then, God punished sin, and God is the same yesterday, today, and forever. So God raises his hand in verse 40. That means he's taking an oath. That's like you in court and you raise your hand before the bailiff and you say, I swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help me God. Well, that's swearing. Well, God, when he raises his hand to heaven, he's swearing, which means it's going to happen. He's not going to lie. He says, as surely as I live forever, and that's sure, because God does live forever. We see this idea of swearing as the Lord lives in Jeremiah 4:2. Then you can swear as the Lord lives in truth, in justice, and in righteousness. As the Lord lives, Numbers 14:21. Yet as surely as I live, and as the whole earth is filled with the Lord's glory, as surely as God lives. Well, that's pretty sure. So you're swearing by something that's sure. Like, you know, we swear on the Bible because allegedly, it used to be, the Bible is the holy word of God, and we're not going to contradict that. And so we swear on the Bible to say that what we're saying is true. Well, God is swearing by his own eternal life, something that's also true, that cannot be false. He says he's going to draw a flashing sword on his enemies. The reason it's flashing is because it's drawn, doing its vengeance. If a sword is put into its holster, its sheath, it won't flash. So this flashing sword means an operative sword. And verse 43 says, rejoice, you nations, concerning his people. Now, why would the nations, the Gentiles, rejoice concerning the Israelites? Well, here's one idea. Even the Gentiles will be blessed by God's judgment on Israel's enemies because they're nasty people. But I think the real reason is because Gentiles in the new covenant will be part of the people of God. And so this is like a prophecy. Rejoice, you nations, rejoice, Gentiles, because God is going to preserve his people. And of course, what Moses didn't know here is his people were going to give birth to the Messiah, and then Jesus is going to establish his church after the resurrection, and all Jews and Gentiles who want to be in that church can be in there, and that's something to rejoice about. We note in the Holman Christian Study Bible that the word concerning is in brackets, so it's not in the original text. So with the word concerning, it reads this way, rejoice, you nations, concerning his people. Rejoice, Gentile nations, concerning his people, the Jews. But if you leave the concerning out and read it this way, rejoice, you nations, his people. That makes the nations God's people, not the Jews, but the nations God's people. And so, therefore, the whole nation should rejoice because of the vengeance that God has taken on the enemies of his word. I don't know which way that goes there, but either I do know this. We Gentiles ought to be rejoicing for what God did back in Old Testament history. Ladies and gentlemen, one little textual note. The Dead Sea Scrolls and the Septuagint add a phrase here in verse 43, so it will read like this. Rejoice, you nations, concerning his people, and inserted here is, and let all the angels worship him, as the NIV says. Well, that's one of those textual differences. It doesn't make a lot of difference either way. So, ladies and gentlemen, we have finished with Deuteronomy 32. In our next audio, Deuteronomy 33, well, actually, we're not going to the next audio, the next chapter. We are going to cover verses 44 through 52 of the same chapter, Deuteronomy 32, and we will see the death of Moses being foretold. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.